legally speaking, as we keep going here. From Mulligan Defense Lawyers, are going to be talking with Michael Mulligan in just a moment. Let's see if we can bring Michael up here. Hey, Michael, are you there?
I'm here. How are you doing?
We've got you. Good. Sorry, we had some technical difficulties during the break here, but we have a solid connection now. We hear you just fine. This is Legally Speaking. What's on our agenda today?
The first case on the agenda is was an unsuccessful appeal from an acquittal on a murder charge, which has some interesting principles people should know about. The case itself dated from back in 2011 in Surrey, and that timing is significant to what went on here. The fact pattern involved a deceased and his wife driving in Surrey behind a 4Runner, which was driving in an erratic fashion. The deceased tried to pass the car, and there was a minor collision when it swerved. The two cars stopped. The deceased got out and walked up to the 4Runner. Some words were exchanged, and without warning, the driver of the 4Runner pulled out a handgun and shot him twice, killing him.
Wow.
Just a tragic circumstance. His wife of the deceased got out of the car and started walking towards the 4Runner, saw the driver aim the handgun at her, and she ducked, and the driver missed, fortunately, so she survived. The 4Runner drove away. The issue was, who was the driver of the 4Runner? Okay. The police got some form of a tip that it might be a particular person and might have been driving a relative's 4Runner, and they were able to obtain a search warrant for that person's house. And that's the first important thing to know about, which is that when the police apply for a search warrant, they need to satisfy a judge or a judicial justice that there are reasonable grounds to believe there's going to be evidence of a particular place and the place they want to search. And a search warrant, when it's authorized, will set out what the police are permitted to go and look for, right? And this particular case authorized the police to go and search the suspect's home to seize, amongst other things, his cell phone. The police showed up to execute the search warrant. They went into the home. 5 adults lived in the home, and they elected to seize all of the cell phones in the home without making any effort to figure out whose was whose. They also saw a surveillance system in the home, like a security camera system, and they seized that too. Now, both of those are potentially problematic. The police, when they're executing a search warrant, if they see some obvious evidence laying out, right, they're not required to leave it there. You know, if you go in to execute a search warrant in a murder case and you see the body laying on the ground, you know, that's not off limits. But you can't go and otherwise just take things that aren't authorized by the search warrant. So they seized all of these phones and the security system, but then didn't do any kind of a careful analysis of the phones. And that brings us to the next problem in the case, which is when the police seize evidence in a criminal investigation, if there is a charge laid, like a person's charged with murder, there's no problem keeping the evidence of the alleged murder, right, if somebody's charged.
Yeah.
But if no one is charged, they can't just keep stuff they took forever, right? Mm. They need permission to keep it. And the first time period would be 3 months. So the idea is that the police take something, pursuant to a search warrant. If they write a report, person's charged, that's no problem. Doesn't matter how long it takes, that stuff can be held on to if it's evidence of the crime, right? That's sort of what you would expect. But if you don't charge somebody and you just take things, it's a requirement, legal requirement, that the police go and get approval to hang on to them when there's no one charged with an offense. Here, the problem was that they didn't do that, and it wasn't an oversight. They, in fact, had a policy not to do that. And here, they kept the cell phones without approval for 6 years, without analyzing them. And they did that despite the fact they were told by Senior Crown, you can't do that. You must get approval to keep these things. They didn't like that advice, and they ignored it. Eventually, after 6 years and with no approval to keep all these phones that they'd seized, they examined them. And lo and behold, on one of the phones, there is an audio of the murder. Okay?
Wow.
So that's the case. That goes in front of the trial judge, and there are a number of challenges raised to what went on here. One of the first challenges was that they didn't have authority to take all these things. And the judge found that they didn't. The search warrant specified they could seize the phone of the suspect, right? So they could look at it to figure out if there's, you know, data that might show he was in the area, whatever it might be. Hmm. But the warrant didn't authorize them to just seize everyone's phone, right? And the officer who testified said, oh, there's no way to know whose phone is whose, which the judge didn't believe for a moment, right? You can imagine all kinds of reasonable things you could do to figure out whose phone is that, right? Yeah. Particularly when you're in a home with five other people, you know, with five people, right? And they didn't do that. So they found, the judge found, first of all, that was unconstitutional and not permitted. But then on the not getting approval, as is clearly required to keep these things, and willfully refusing to do that, despite being told clearly that they are required to do it, was viewed by the trial judge as very serious. And in a criminal case where there is a breach of somebody's rights, like in this case, constitutional right to be free from unreasonable search and seizure, for example, right? Yes. When the police breach somebody's rights, it's not automatic that evidence they get will be excluded. In Canada, there is a weighing under Section 24.2, and a judge has to consider, should the evidence be allowed in the trial despite some unconstitutional conduct by the police? And when a judge is doing that, they need to weigh up things, including, like, how serious was the breach? Was this just some slip-up or somebody got the wrote down the wrong address or something, right? Or is this serious conduct, like here, where the judge and now the Court of Appeal have upheld the decision that this was a flagrant, willful, knowing breach, right? It's the, and that's the conduct, and the Crown eventually agreed that was so. And the judge found that when you have what was described as egregious institutional systemic disregard for a legal requirement, despite being told clearly by more than one senior Crown, you've got to get approval to keep this, just willfully deciding we're not doing that, made what went on here particularly serious. And the judge said, look, I just cannot countenance that kind of willful refusal to do what is legally required. And ultimately, the decision about whether evidence should be admitted turns on whether allowing the evidence to be used would sort of undermine faith in the justice system, right? That's sort of a concept there, right? And when you have sort of serious, willful breaches like this, not just some mistake, but repeated serious problems, which were institutional, like they're told to do it and they just refused. The judge found that despite how serious the case was, the evidence just couldn't be used. You just can't countenance the police just willfully ignoring what they're clearly legally required to do. And so the result of that is that the evidence found in the cell phone was not admissible, and the man was acquitted. And the Crown has appealed that, but as the Crown agreed on the appeal, you know, this was, the Crown said, they conceded the police engaged in flagrant, deliberate, and egregious breaches of what's required of them. And the result of that is that there was no remedy for the court of from the Court of Appeal either. And so despite having an audio recording of the murder on one of these phones, because of how the police decided to deal with that and keep them, the result is there will be no trial on the merits, and the man has not been convicted. So that's the latest from the Court of Appeal on why the police just need to follow the legal requirements if they want to keep and eventually be able to use evidence they've seized.
Michael Mulligan with Mulligan Defense Lawyers. Legally Speaking, we'll continue right after this.
Adam Sterling on CFAX 1070 and streaming on the iHeartRadio app.
All right, we're back on the air here at CFAX 1070. It's Legally Speaking with Michael Mulligan, barrister and solicitor with Mulligan Defense Lawyers. Michael, next up on the agenda, I see here a First Nation, an appeal regarding a hydro dam removed on the basis that it's a legal nuisance. What happened here?
Well, this is a significant case out of the Court of Appeal. It was just released. And this and other litigation in this area is going to have a real potential impacts for things in British Columbia, including how energy is generated, right? In BC, we're pretty fortunate in that most of our electrical energy is generated by hydro dams, right? And the hope is that over time there'll be more of that. But we have a long way to go. When I last looked it up, in BC, 16% of our energy is generated is electricity, right? The rest is made up largely of petroleum products and natural gas.
Yeah.
And so the hope is that we would be able to increase the amount of electricity we're using and decrease how much gas and natural gas we're using. But, boy, we've got a long way to go. We're at 16%, and the rest are things that are rather more polluting. And so that brings us to this. And this particular piece of litigation involves the Kennedy Dam, and that's a dam that's on the Nechako River. And it was built in the 1950s. It was built by Alcan to provide power for aluminum smelting. And the power is now used for both that and general public use, right? It's also, some of it goes for that. And to give an idea of the scale of that dam, the Kennedy Dam produces 890 megawatts, right? The Site C Dam, when it's complete, will produce 1,100 megawatts, so almost as big as the Site C Dam. That's of a total in BC of some 18,000 and change megawatts. So it's a pretty big dam. I guess that's the point.
Okay.
And the legal case was brought by Indigenous or First Nations in the area. And it was brought, interestingly, on the basis of a claim of nuisance. And you went, oh, what's that? well, there is, as a matter of, there's a common law tort of nuisance, right? Mm. And a nuisance is, you know, if you do something which is going to seriously interfere with somebody's property rights, you could have a legal claim in nuisance, right?
Interesting.
You know, let's say somebody set up, a pig farm next to your house, right, or something, you made it so you couldn't breathe, the stink coming off it, right? You might have a claim in nuisance. Say, hey, I can't live in my house. It's just overwhelming stink, something like that, right? So that's what a nuisance is. And here, the claim made by the First Nations is they said, look, this dam blocks and restricts the amount of water flowing down the river, and it's flooded an area for its reservoir, right? Mm-hmm. And their claim was that, look, we have an Indigenous right to fish, and the restriction on water caused by this dam reduces the amount of fish available to us. Therefore, you're creating a nuisance, right? Just like somebody who sets up something stinky or loud next to your house, right? And as a matter of tort law, nuisance is pretty broad, right? It's interfering or disturbing a person's exercise or enjoyment or of land that they own or occupy. So, okay, there it is. It's a creative claim. And the defense raised by the aluminum company and ultimately the province of British Columbia and the federal government was a defense of statutory authority. And this is how that works with a nuisance claim. The basic idea is that if you are authorized to do something by statute, and this was that, there was statutory authority to build the dam, as you would sort of expect, right? You can't just go build a, you know, aluminum company, you can't just go build a dam somewhere. So there was legal authority to build it. And there's a concept that when you do something that you're statutorily permitted to do, things which are necessarily flowing from that can't be the basis for a nuisance claim, okay? And so that's the defense raised by the company that built the dam and by the province and the federal government. And there's an interesting case. It actually comes out of Victoria from back in 1999, which provides some legal meaning to, well, what is that defense that you might have, the defense of statutory authority? And it came out of a fact pattern in Victoria where a person on a motorcycle got their wheel stuck in one of the railway lines that used to run through across a road.
Hmm.
Right? You remember those? We used to have those downtown, yeah, kind of where they bought the bridge going over towards Capital Iron. I think that's where that this happened.
Okay.
And so the person's wheel got stuck in the rail track. And the railway, their defense was statutory authority. We have statutory authority to put these rails in here. And in fact, there are regulations that specify how wide the flange waves need to be. And there was a range of permitted size. So they said, hey, we're just doing what we are statutorily authorized to do. You can't then successfully sue us claiming that we created a nuisance that your motorcycle got stuck in when we're doing what was statutorily authorized to do, put this railway in. That case, the Victoria one, got all the way to the Supreme Court of Canada. And the Supreme Court of Canada said, yes, this is a defense, but it should be viewed relatively narrowly on the idea that the activity that you're saying is protected by the statutory authority has to be an inevitable result of what you're statutorily permitted to do, right? So if there's statutory authority to, you can build that dam, if inevitably there's going to be a nuisance created by, yeah, there's a big wall of concrete there, right? There's water backed up, there's less going down, that's kind of the nature of a dam, that it can amount to a defense. The problem for the railway company in that case out of Victoria was that the railway made a decision to exceed the minimum flangeway size by more than 1 inch. They made the gap bigger than they had to, right? Hmm. And so ultimately they weren't able to rely upon that defense. And so that's the heart of the legal framework that was first of all dealt with at this massive trial that went on for more than 150 days, and now this appeal. And on that point, the First Nations lost at trial, and on appeal, indeed, the Court of Appeal upheld the trial judge's decision, saying, yep, this was protected by this defense of statutory authority, the permission to build the dam necessarily is causing the nuisance, and so you cannot successfully sue them on that basis. What the Court of Appeal did do, however, is that they expanded the language of some declaratory relief that the judge provided. And declaratory relief is sort of like that. It's like somebody's saying, I do declare something. It's not an order to do something. It's sort of a statement of, you know, what the law is to sort of direct people in the future in terms of how they should be conducting themselves. And the Court of Appeal sort of expanded on what the judge said by saying that the fiduciary duty owed by the provincial and federal governments creates a obligation on them to try to minimize the impact, on their right to fish on that river, which is constitutionally protected. And so that's going to create a basis for there to be likely further negotiations about either should they get some money for the reduced fish in the river because of the dam, or, for example, the other thing discussed was, should there be some change in terms of how much water can be held behind the dam, right? Should there be a requirement that more be allowed to flow through, even if it's not generating electricity? Largely, that statutory defense was upheld. They're not required to rip the dam down, nor is there going to be compensation ordered for the reduced fish resulting from the nuisance of the dam. But that's there. And that's going to, as I said, guide likely further negotiations about this and may have an impact in the future about things like water stored and what about other dams. And all of that is just very important, right, given what we talked about at the outset in terms of electrical power and what the province is trying to do in that regard. And it's clear we've got, even as things stand, a potential overall shortage of electrical power because there's increased demand for it with heat pumps and electric cars and all the things that we're trying to get people to start using so we don't pollute as much, right? But that's got to come from somewhere. And this is an example of just how some of those decisions, there's just going to be conflict in terms of use. And this kind of thing was also at the heart of a thing we talked about previously. The provincial government tried to introduce with no notice to anyone, or virtually no notice to anyone, changes to the Land Act,
which yeah. would have
provided, had it passed, potential for additional sort of veto authority for First Nations over the use of Crown land. Because of the pushback they got over, I think, how they tried to do that, kind of slip it in on a website and give no press release and don't tell anyone, they've just announced the other week they are withdrawing that effort, probably until after the election, because as you might imagine, there are some real conflicting interests here, right? There are legitimate interests about First Nations rights to land and right to fish. And on the other hand, you've got all sorts of interests in terms of things like climate change and decarbonization. And to a significant extent, there's just no way around it. They're in conflict. And so that is likely why that decision was made not to advance that piece of legislation at this time, because both of those groups would, of course, be groups that the current government would hope to get support from. And you're just not going to please everyone, right? If you if you let water flow through and don't build dams so there's more fishing available for First Nations, then we're going to be using more natural gas, right? If you want to stop that, there's going to be an impact on it. There are tough decisions to be made about that. And if we want to have any hope of meeting any of the sort of, you know, the objectives we always hear about what's going to happen in 2030 or 2035 or 2040, whatever year with a round number at the end of it, we need to have a very significant increase in the amount of electricity we generate. And so we have to have some hard discussions and make some difficult decisions about where's that coming from, because right now we're sitting at 16%. And so if we want to get up from there, it's got to come from somewhere. And this case is an important one. It may well go to the Supreme Court of Canada, and this and others are going to be guiding lights in terms of what is and can be done. And how are we going to advance the ball on those two files? And how are we supposed to weigh those things up? And so that's the case involving nuisance that has its origin in part of the legal origin in a motorcycle getting stuck in a train track in Victoria. So that's the latest of the Kennedy Dam.
Michael Mulligan with Mulligan Defense Lawyers. I learn something new every week. It's Legally Speaking on CFAX 1070. Michael, thank you as always. Always a pleasure.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
All right. You too. Until next week.